The interview is with Gus Casely-Hayford, a cultural historian and broadcaster. This month, Gus is presenting the BBC 4 series Lost Kingdoms of Africa, which explores the history of a number of former African states. One of these is the Asante Kingdom in modern-day Ghana, which rose to prominence in the 18th century through its mineral wealth and involvement in the slave trade. As Gus is himself of partly Ghanaian descent, the Asante story has a special resonance for him. I caught up with Gus recently to find out more about this golden kingdom.
So we're talking about here the Asante Kingdom.
Yes.
Whereabouts in Africa is that located?
Okay.
What's that located?
And the Asante, that they are part of the Akan people, who are one of the major West African ethnic groups. And the Asante, that they lived in the interior of what is today Ghana. The coastal region was peopled by a group called the Fante. And just to the north of them were their cousins, who they were very often at war with, the Asante. And the Asante were very different from the Fante in a variety of ways. They shared the base of a language, but in many other ways they were extremely different. The Asante had huge wealth. The Fante, that they, because they were on the coast, that they were fishermen. And over a period of time, that their traditions seemed to diverge and they grew to be very, very different and were very often at war.
And you mentioned the huge wealth of the Asante.
Yes.
Is that because of the gold they had in the area?
Yeah, that this is a region which is very heavily forested. And the forest isn't just dense, but also because the weather, the intensity of the humidity is so great, it actually meant that they're very isolated populations. But beneath the soil was incredibly rich deposits of gold. And this is a really, really high quality gold as well. And so from very, very earliest periods, people were aware that the people who lived in this region, in the forests, that they could trade this incredible gold. And it's traded north across the desert and south to the coast. And the Asante, that they grow up in this region amongst a number of different ethnic groups who are all competing for control of this gold.
And when do the Asante first enter the historical record, do we know?
Well, it's difficult. I mean, the Portuguese, that they arrive on the coast in the late 14th century. And they have reports of a number of kingdoms, and it may well be that the forefathers of the Asante were already in the region that the Asante came to inhabit. But at that period, the main kingdom in the interior were the Denchira.
Right.
And the Denchira, that they're very, very powerful and incredibly ruthless. They're not loved by the people that they rule over. They rule over a confederation of smaller kingdoms, and they do so with an incredible sort of ruthless kind of authoritarianism. And people, I mean, because they're isolated, they do rely upon the Denchira for defence, and in lean times they rely on them for resources. But in return for that, the Denchira, that they demand a huge amount, gold particularly, but also men, troops, to fight the ever-expanding ambitions of the Denchira to widen their empire. And one of the kingdoms, or one of the small kingships that sit under the Denchira, are the Asante. And they grow tired, along with all the others, of this bullying administration. And there is a period when basically that there are enough people within the Asante to begin to feel that possibly they could take on the Denchira.
Do we know why it was the Asante rather than any of the other kingdoms that actually took this step in the end?
I think it's a period in which many of these these groups are actually, they're actually held together by quite fragile infrastructure, because these territories are isolated, the terrain is incredibly difficult to navigate, and so politically it is possible to cut off people. It is possible to challenge the status quo. But having the guts to do it, when you have a state like the Denchira, who are incredibly ruthless, that they would just literally wipe out their enemies, and they would enslave anyone they could, and, you know, put them... They would have put them into forced labour. And the consequences were so dreadful that many people just wouldn't take them on. But the Asante, that they are ruled by Osei Tutu, who is a young man, and he basically just feels the time is right. You know, I'm going to take these people on. And what he actually uses, he is not just military might, but he uses... diplomacy. He uses a chap called Akomfo Anoche, who is, he's a sort of Peter Mandelson type right. figure, you know, a bit of a sort of spin doctor. And what he manages to do is to gradually build a confederation, a coalition of these disaffected sub-states. And they all begin to stand against the Denchira. They begin one by one to say, we're not going to stand for it anymore. And when there are enough of them, they take on the Denchira. And the consequences of losing are, you know, this is zero sum. You lose and you will be annihilated. But along with their incredible sort of... skills at diplomacy, they are great military tacticians, and they beat the Denchira and they drive them out of the area. And what the Asante then realize is that they have a very loose confederation that is built up basically because of their shared dislike of the Denchira. They don't really share very much more than that. And what they want to do is to build a coherent state. And so that happens in a number of ways. And they are really clever. They decide that they're going to clear the forest. They're going to use the land that they're going to get from the cleared forests to grow crops that will mean that they can support larger numbers of people. That they're also going to bring new people into those cleared areas to then make up a bigger army so that they can protect their region. But additionally, that what they want to do is to deploy those people into things like gold mining and actually working the gold mines. And what the Asante are even more clever at is saying that only the Asantehene can hold wealth. You know, this is a period in which there isn't really fluid currency, that the only people who own things are the aristocracy, and the Asantehene is at the top of this pyramid. And so it's very difficult to challenge the growth of this state. It just continues to grow, accumulating new states and forcing these vassal states into a kind of slavery. And these people would work on the land, clearing the land, growing the Asante state bit by bit. Incrementally, it becomes almost unassailable.
And the Asante gold, is that eventually find its way into, say, European markets?
Well, the Europeans, that they arrive on the coast, the Portuguese, they are eventually displaced by, you know, the French and the Swedes and then the British. And they realise that this bit of the coast is very rich in gold, and that it's worth all of the problems, the encroachments, the ongoing encroachments of the Asante, the difficult weather, and so they begin to trade via their coastal allies, the Fanti, with the Asante for gold. And the gold that comes out of that region is of an incredibly high quality, and huge amounts of it too.
But the Asante also then become involved in slavery as well, and the slave trade.
Yeah, because the Asante, that they are trying to increase increase their region. They realise that the gold production is also, it demands lots of manpower, and the only way to the only way to man their armies, their gold fields, their farms, is by deploying slaves. And so they expand, and they raid their neighbours, and they use the people that they capture as slaves. But over a period of time, they get so good at this that there's actually a surfeit of labour, and they begin to then trade that labour, and that labour becomes something which is as lucrative almost as the gold trade.
And the labour, the slave labour that they're trading, do these people then end up in the Americas, some of them?
Well, the over a period of time, that the British, who consolidate their position on the coast, that they, because of the way in which the trade winds and the tides operate, that they usually sail out from the west coast of Africa west toward the Caribbean. They don't sail direct toward Europe. Mm. So there's a trading triangle, and what usually would fill the boats between West Africa and the Caribbean would be people. It would be slaves who would have been captured in the interior, in the Asante region, and they would travel down the trade routes to the coast, held usually in castles, huge castles like Cape Coast, which had almost like on an industrial scale sort of areas in their basement, which are appalling when you go and you see them. Very dark dungeons where people would be held for sometimes weeks at a time, and then from there they go pass through something that would be called the Gate of No Return, onto boats, and then from there onto ships, and then out to the Caribbean. And this became an incredibly lucrative trade. You know, possibly 500,000, maybe more, people travelled through Cape Coast on their way to the Caribbean. And it made the Europeans, the British, you know, incredibly wealthy. But at the same time, throughout the 18th century, that there were a number of people who looked at this industry and just said, it's just plainly wrong, morally wrong. And, you know, this is a period in which expansion, money, adventure was obviously kind of, it was important to Britain. But the actual kind of, the actual moral arguments seemed to win the day. And you know, at the turn of the 19th century, there is this huge move to end slavery and to outlaw it. And the outlawing of slavery completely, it destabilizes the ecology, the local balance on the Gold Coast. Because for the Asante, their whole economy has now been, has been refocused around supplying slaves to the coast.
So the Asante essentially prevented the British from having to go into the interior of Africa to get the slaves. They could wait on the coast, and the Asante would bring them the slaves.
Well, if you imagine that these incredibly thick forests and the weather, the strength of the Asante army, that they form a kind of formidable barrier between the coast and the interior. And it is very, even with superior weaponry, it is difficult for the British to take on the Asante, and they do. But I think over a period of time, as the British begin to feel more confident about their place on the coast, that they begin to assert themselves. And the Asante get incredibly frustrated at the idea of their old trading relationship with the British being challenged and then dismantled. And so they, you know, they try to continue to trade slaves, even though it's been outlawed. The British blocked them in a number of instances, and then, out of frustration, they actually the Asante that they kidnap some Europeans from the coast, from a place called Elmina, and this results in the British actually putting their foot down and forcing the Asante to acknowledge that it really is the end of slavery, and they do that by force.
So the British go into the Asante Kingdom, and am I right, they eventually colonise it?
Well, in 1873, the British, that they do eventually enter the Asante into Kumasi, the capital, and the Asante, realising that the British have superior numbers, weaponry, that they try at the very last moment to negotiate, but by then it's just too late. Mm. And the Asantehene, the king's palace, is burnt to the ground. And before this has happened, the kingdom's already begun to unravel because the economy is in tatters, in a sense that the political balance between the king and all of the dignitaries and the aristocracy that surround the king and the merchants that support them is all been about slavery, and it's been about the old system. With the unravelling of that the Asantehene's power and the respect that he had is beginning to be questioned. And when the British enter Kumasi, razing the palace to the ground, that it seems almost like it is the beginning of the end. But what the British are very clever at is that they don't then declare the Kumasi and the Asante area to be a protectorate. They withdraw, and they actually then declare the coastal area a protectorate, but what they allow is for the Asante region to continue to unravel. And what happens is that it draws down a lot of the mercantile expertise, the wealth, into the British region. People want to begin, rather than to continue to trade with the now what seem like moribund Asante, they want to begin to think about investing in the British, who seem to be the future.
So once they've been able to go and attack the capital, really the Asante's respect is going to be diminished because they couldn't fight off the British at that moment.
Exactly, exactly. But at this time, that it feels like it's the end, that the Asante kingdom is going to unravel. And there are consecutive fairly weak Asantehenes, kings. And so even people within the court are beginning to question the viability of the kingdom. But then a woman, Yasantiwa, she has been a member of the royal family but hasn't really asserted herself before this time. But she steps forward and she petitions for a close relative of hers, Prempeh, to become the Asantehene. And what Prempeh, he's a young man, very young, and that would seem to be kind of not experienced enough, but he is someone who wants to rebuild the Asante stall as it once was, and he wants to focus it again as it was focused originally around the traditions that were set up by the founder of the Asante state, Osei Tutu. And what Osei Tutu had been very careful in doing is bringing all of those disparate states together around a number of symbols, things like a golden stool, kente, drumming. Mm. These traditions were the things around which the original state actually rallied. And once again, the Asante state begins to grow confident, and it looks to these old symbols as a way of reviving itself. And it seems like for the British, you know, they're thinking, gosh, we thought they were dead in the water. And suddenly, it looks like the Asante are growing again in confidence. And it's, you know, unfortunately, what happens is that the Asante are unable to actually are unable to deliver, and the British, realizing that they may well be kind of in a position where the balance might shift against them, that they again put pressure on the Asante state, but this time it is devastating, and it does kind of completely mean the end of the kingship. And what they do is to remove the Asantehene. He's not just destalled, but he's sent away. And for a period of time that they try to administer the stall themselves before reinstating it, but then as a stall that is basically just centred around the capital, Kumasi. It's not really about the state. And what the British realised, though, is that even though the Asante state has been completely devastated, it's no longer what it was, either in terms of geography or economics. It still seems to have a kind of residual emotional pull for the local people. And partially that is because the symbols that Osai Tutu, the first Asantehene, had established of kente, of drumming, but particularly of the golden stool, that they still seem to be of importance. And so they try, the British, to confiscate the golden stool. They asked many times for the golden stool to be given up, and they'd simply refuse. And in the end, they give up a fake one, but they never relinquish the true one. And in a way that when Osai Tutu actually established the Asante stool, what he was very clever, he and Akomfo Anoche, this sort of Peter Mandelson figure, what they're very clever in doing is creating a kind of distance between the holder of the stool and the stool itself. It's the stool that is the important thing. That's where the continuity is invested. And so much of Asante culture is about stories, it's about history. And that history is invested in objects like cloth and like drums, but particularly in the stool. So by keeping the stool, they actually felt that they had kept, in a way, the integrity of the kingship alive. And so even without a king, without a state, without the wealth that they once had, they could still rally around this symbol and feel that the Asante state endured.
And does it still endure today in some respects?
Well, the interesting thing is that the British realised fairly quickly that to administer a state like that, probably the best way of doing it was to reinstate something quite similar. Mm. And so over a period of time, they did reinstate the stool. And if you go today, it's not just that the Asante stool is powerful and it's loved, but it works as a political and an economic unit, that the Asante stool still gets money from the gold that is mined in that region. And the Asante goldfields are incredibly rich even today. I had an opportunity to go into one of the gold mines, and the gold that is the gold that is drawn from the mines every day produces huge ingots, you know, that these ingots are like $1 million each, and that on a single day you can see two or three of these that are produced, and that, you know, I've sat and watched the gold being poured and held one of these ingots, and you get a sense that this isn't just about contemporary economics. There's still a pride in the history that's connected to the gold that's drawn out of the soil. There is an idea that that very place is special. And I suppose in the golden stool is a continuity, not just a connection to the gold, but an idea that the actual authority of the Asantehene, the rootedness to that place, is something which is fundamental to that state, and that not even in their darkest hours, when the British had seemed to have overrun them, when their economy was smashed, not even then was the golden stool given up. And that is about the integrity of those beliefs, of that history.
What do you see as the legacy of this state? Because obviously there's quite a negative aspect with all the slavery, but also clearly they had quite strong aspects too, and managed to stand up to the British for quite a long time. So how would you view their legacy?
I think their legacy, I mean, if you think about, you know, in Britain, that, I mean, there aren't... Ghana is not, in terms of numbers, that large an African country. But if you look around the world at the influence of Ghanaians, Kofi Annan, you know, if you think about in Britain, politicians like, you know, Boateng, you know, that there is a kind of a tradition of people who have a kind of a skill and eloquence that I think is rooted, connected to the way in which history, in which telling of stories, in which the keeping of folklore is so important. And I think in a way that the legacy that against this incredible landscape, this very, very difficult environment, against all of those odds, what they were so keen to do was to keep alive the story, the history. And in Ghanaians today, there is still that sense that history, that story, is absolutely vital. And so even for those slaves that were cast out over the ocean into the New World, the thing that still seems to survive are those stories that, you know, you travel in the Caribbean or the New World, and it is the stories, you know, Brer stories, the stories of Anansi. These are stories that actually travelled with them, you know, with slavery. And in a way, the legacy is the story, the history. And I think for a people who began with stories, I think, you know, that's very fitting.
I mean, I remember those stories when I was growing up. I had no idea they came from Ghana originally.
Yes, those are stories that travelled with slavery. And if you think about so much slavery was about completely trying to eradicate the past and getting people to completely inculcated with a kind of Euro-American sensibility. But some of it was just so important to those people that they held on to it. And those stories of, it's not just of origin, but the Anansi stories particularly of tricksters, of railing against possibility and authority, that in a way that is partially the Asante way of trying to find ways out of a situation. And, you know, if you think about the golden stool, that even when they did have their backs up against the wall, that they did manage to find a way to...